Workplace chat and collaboration technology company Slack is going public on June 20th, with implications for a wide variety of companies in the Seattle region and beyond. Microsoft is Slack's primary competitor with its Teams service, and Slack is a big Amazon Web Services customer. But beyond that, many companies that sell technologies to businesses will be watching Slack's stock market debut closely to assess their own potential in the public markets. This week on GeekWire, we're doing a deep dive on Slack with a pair of episodes exploring its underlying business and technology. Later in the week, we'll talk with a PitchBook analyst who just published a major report on Slack. And on this episode, we're featuring a conversation with a co-founder of Slack, Cal Henderson, the company's chief technology officer. Cal previously led the Flickr engineering team as its chief software architect. He was also an early pioneer in the use of web APIs. I'm GeekWire editor Todd Bishop, and I spoke with Cal Henderson at the recent GeekWire Cloud Summit about Slack's history as an accidental enterprise technology company and its approach to engineering in the cloud era.
So, Cal, sort of the elephant in the room in this entire discussion is going to be June 20th, which is the, according to the SEC, not to you, but to the SEC, the date of Slack's IPO, to use the colloquial term, but the direct filing that Slack will be doing. So my goal is to get through this with you revealing as much information as possible and not having to say no comment. But if you do have to say no comment, well, I don't know, I'll just keep pushing on it. So you have been through some fascinating pivots with Stuart Butterfield and team. You've made multiple video games and then gone into other products.
Yeah.
Tell us about your journey from the beginning pre-Flickr to Slack today.
Yeah, so I've been working with the same set of people and co-founders for a couple of decades now. What we've been doing and the kind of environment that we've been working in has changed significantly over that time, but there's definitely a couple of kind of common patterns. Starting way back in kind of 2001, we started a company to make video games on the internet, which was a terrible time to make video games on the internet because there weren't such things at that point. Nobody had kind of plugged those two together. And we totally failed to do that at the time, but that turned into Flickr, which at the time was fairly successful. Then fast forward a little bit after the acquisition by Yahoo in 2005, and we wanted to get back and try and do the same thing again. The internet had changed a huge amount in the kind of in the five, six years before that. There were so many more people on the web. There was kind of the rise of social networks, and people were used to interacting with each other online. Around that time as well was the rise of Zynga. And for a brief moment in time, it seemed like online games was going to be a real source of revenue as well. So it was easy to raise capital at that time to make games. And we had this grand plan. We were finally going to be able to, bring to market this vision that we'd had years before and been unable to realize at the time. Like, this time around, we had everything going for us. We were able to raise funding. Technology had moved along a long way. There were a lot more people on the internet, and people were willing to pay money for things over the internet. And we totally failed to execute on it with everything going for us. And I think we're just, quite bad at making video games, it turns out. But what we did luck into was another pivot into something else. And so Slack came to be because as we were working on the game project, which was called Glitch at the time, probably nobody here played Glitch. It's also why it doesn't exist anymore. When we were trying to make the game, we were split between San Francisco and Vancouver. And we built a set of tools to be able to communicate and collaborate better. We spent 4 years working on this game. We built the whole business around it, every kind of workflow from the development side to the artwork creation to level building to accounting to customer support. We built it all into this tool we were building ourselves. And it was a great way to work together. And we didn't really think about it as like we're building a product. It's just we want to get our work done and we're developers, so we use software to do that. And when we shut the game down, we were trying to think about what we wanted to do next, we realized that whatever it was we did next, we wanted to keep working together in the same way. Like, it wasn't just the tool set, it was the way in which we were working together. It made us a lot more productive, it made work feel different as a team of people spread across different offices around the world. And we thought, if we like that as a team, a company of kind of 40, 50 people at the time, maybe other companies doing similar things would find that tool useful as well. So that's where Slack came from.
you had used this for so long internally, you almost had this very extended private beta test. You were so stable in terms of even the UI in many ways.
We had the model, you know, almost 10 years ago now of that way of communicating. I think there's kind of two core concepts at the heart of the product that we stumbled upon. One is, and neither of them in isolation was an entirely new thing. The first one was using channels instead of using email. That is, instead of, you know, one-to-one communication by default, organizing communication, discussion, and work around topic, or whether that's kind of topic or project or team. It's a very, you know, kind of straightforward idea, but I think the thing that it shifts is this idea of, you know, we've been using email in the workplace for about 40 years, give or take, and it has a whole bunch of assumptions built into it. You know, it's a one-to-one communication medium by default. You know, you address the people you're sending to, and it's a very push model. You know, and we switched to more of a pull model with channels, where you choose what you want to subscribe to. But more than that, when you join an organization that uses email, you start on day one with an empty inbox, and you have zero context of what happened before. And if you leave that organization or that team, the information that is locked up in your inbox just dies. And for as work has become increasingly more complex and more collaborative, and people join projects or teams and leave them over time, that ability to have a record that's preserved independent of the people involved, I think, is huge. Then on the other side is the kind of the applications and platform aspect. I think the one of the most interesting trends, which is very tied to cloud-related topics, which I'm sure we'll talk about, has been the real explosion of software used in the workplace over the last 10 years. In a Netscope study, which is now even 2 years old, the average mid to large size company is using more than 1,000 different applications. And that's just an insane number of different bits of software. I'm not sure I could name 1,000 different bits of software. And that's the average for a mid-sized company. And that's such a big change from a decade or two decades ago. And it has been what's enabled that, I'm sure we'll talk about. But where enterprises are using more and more software, it's just become more and more, where work happens has become more and more fragmented. It's like work from this team happens in this application, work from this team happens in this set of applications, and this department uses this set of applications to get work done. And it has meant work is more fragmented. And I think one of the patterns that we hit upon was, what if we can pull all of that work together at the communication layer?
Absolutely, and Slack now has more than 10 million average daily users. So clearly you've struck a nerve, and as we mentioned, you're soon to be a public company. Let's talk about the technical challenges that you faced in the build-up to that 2013 launch. What types of decisions did you make at that point, technically, and what can this audience learn from them?
Well, I think there's a few different things we could talk about there. One is that when we started the company, I don't think we had any vision of how large it could be, of how generally applicable it could be. Because when we were building it for ourselves, we knew that we'd built a product that worked well for teams exactly like us, of somewhere between 5 and 100 people, and initially of like engineering teams building software. And we knew that worked well for us, and we thought that worked well for that use case. I think it became very quickly apparent to us that it worked kind of across all different job functions and sizes of the company as well. But so saying, to begin with, we definitely didn't build it thinking that we'd have more than 10 million daily active users or beyond. And so we were just, and I think this is kind of for nearly any kind of software that any company is building outside of a few giant companies, the most important thing that you need to do is find that product market fit quickly. And it's not about like, if this goes perfectly on every possible axis, what is the total addressable market we'll see over the next 20 years and build to that? Because the first thing you build is not gonna be the right thing. And the very first version that we put in people's hands was definitely not the right thing. And we needed to be able to iterate on that really quickly. And so the focus definitely for the first couple of years was on finding what would translate from what we had built and worked for us to what would work for more people. So iterating quickly, understanding how other teams worked and what the frustrations would be, and really honing in on that product market fit. So I think that it's, I'm an engineer. I'm very excited by new and interesting and exciting technologies. And you know, I'm definitely interested on the large scale distributed system side. I think it can be super kind of addicting to go and build something for massive scale, which you will then never see. And finding that balance is really tough. And it's the, you don't want to paint yourself into a corner and be able to build something which you will never be able to deliver at scale if you are successful. But it's the that iteration at the beginning that's key.
So you are on the cloud now. In fact, we know that you're primarily on Amazon Web Services. Would you have been able to scale to the extent you have and efficiently as you have without those cloud technologies?
It would have been much, much harder. Back when we started the first company and built Flickr, we had our own physical data center, and we had to go and buy servers, and we were in Canada, so we had to buy servers and then drive down to the border to go and talk to the customs people to get them out of customs, and then take them to the data center and rack them and install Linux from a CD, and then realize we didn't have enough network cables and go down to the shop and buy network cables. And it's like, that was a quarter to a third of all of our time was just like useless, undifferentiated work that we had to do. So like the move from hosting your own small data, you know, having your own physical servers at the small scale to moving to infrastructure as a service or platform as a service was an incredible time saving. Like it has really been the thing that has driven the ability for this explosion in software categories, because kind of niche SaaS businesses that just could not have existed a decade ago without AWS, GCP, Azure can now exist, because you just don't have to put in that either upfront capital investment or massive investment of time to be able to get to the point when you're proving out your product and finding that product market fit.
If you were launching something like Slack today or Slack today, what would you do differently given the mistakes you made back then, but also the evolution of the cloud and the available technologies since then?
Yeah, I think on the first one, sure, we made lots of product mistakes and now we have a lot more data. So I think like we wouldn't make any of the mistakes we made. But I think the cloud side is more interesting, and that is that, you know, we've moved a lot more from the kind of infrastructure as a service 10 years ago to more of the platform as a service and higher level kind of like moving further up the stack and being more hosted services as opposed to just we'll provide you with virtual machines very quickly. And I think that it's a continuation of the same thing. It's what can we do to avoid doing undifferentiated work that everybody else does, which doesn't make us any particularly better at the thing we're delivering. So, you know, we use Kubernetes and we use more kind of high-level hosted AWS services, for instance. And it just lets us spend more time on the things that are unique to us as a service or a company.
And I know that circa 2015, there was an AWS case study, and you were relying heavily on EC2 at AWS. Is that still a core part of your infrastructure?
It's definitely still a core part of our infrastructure. I think I was definitely historically skeptical of higher level services, but we've just started to adopt them more and more over time. And I think that's, you know, whether that's kind of on the data warehouse side, I think that was probably where we made a big shift first quite some time ago into more hosted services, but kind of more across the board, we're moving further up the stack. And that's the same from all the major cloud providers.
So given that, what are the fundamental cloud technologies, the key things in your toolbox today at Slack?
We use a lot of different services and technology. I think Kubernetes and containers have been big for us in rethinking the way that we make engineers effective and productive. It's how much control of, you know, deployed services can we put in the hands of engineers. The model of the past was you have an operations team, and that transition to like everybody's a bit DevOps, and to more, you don't really think about it so much as operations. It is part of building software is running it and deploying it now. And I think the lowering the technical barrier to being able to be DevOps-y by putting more tools in the hands of your developers, and that being the expectation of you build it and you support that service, has really changed how we think about building software.
We know this from the S1, and I know you can't comment on this, but we know that Slack spends a minimum of $50 million a year with AWS. Big picture, in the abstract, how do you think about issues like operating on multiple clouds, vendor lock-in, switching costs, and the whole concept of wanting to stay flexible, but also wanting to have maximum efficiency. How do you weigh those things in Slack's operations?
You know, if you think about it from an efficiency point of view, engineer developer time is actually super expensive. So the idea that we could that we will tune for the ability for fast iteration and for fast development cycles over anything else is probably what we're concentrated on. So that's the real differentiator. There are definitely very particular businesses where it might not make sense to use a cloud provider. You need a very particular resource at massive scale, or you need some kind of service or hardware that doesn't exist in the cloud. But for nearly any kind of business of small to medium scale, it makes a ton of sense because your developer costs are high and your opportunity costs are the highest thing. It's like, what could you be doing instead of thinking about how to do a very small cost optimization in the grand scheme of things? You could be thinking about how to get to market quicker, how to provide that next iteration for your customers.
But what if you were to say, okay, AWS, we want to shift over to Google Cloud. How technically feasible is that in reality? Because on the surface, it looks like many of these services and cloud services are similar, at least in purpose. Is that kind of migration possible or pragmatic or practical?
It is. The services, or at least the three big services, are more similar than ever. You know, they each have a particular thing that they're better at or that they target more. It's a lot of work because very dependent on scale, but as your application, as your service gets more and more complex, you become more and more dependent on the small operational details of how that particular provider works or how that particular service works. It's like, broadly, this queue service is the same as this queue service, is the same as this queue service, but the exact characteristics under load or under failure conditions are things that you end up building around. And so there is definitely cost to doing that.
How do you weigh that in terms of the volume of workload that you put on one single vendor?
The thing that I'm most concentrated on is developer velocity. So it's how quickly can people iterate on it? So whether that's for some time, like GCP as a provider was far ahead in offering ML, AI-like services. So if I have a team that wants to build something around those technologies, then GCP is going to be the way to do that at that particular point in time. And it's that speed of iteration and delivery that's more important than anything else.
You're listening to GeekWire, and we'll be right back.
I wanted a career in IT, but I didn't know where to start. WGU makes it simple. Their accredited online degree programs cover all kinds of IT specialties, and they have valuable industry certifications built in at no extra cost. The payoff? Having those certs back up my degree makes me look even better to future employers. A nonprofit university that includes top industry certs in their programs? I choose WGU. Learn more at wgu.edu/IT certs included.
Let's return now to our conversation with Cal Henderson, the co-founder and CTO of Slack, at the recent GeekWire Cloud Summit.
So let's talk about AI and ML, because it has been obviously a recurring theme, and I think it's perhaps the most common high-level cloud service that a lot of people talk about, and it's becoming and use and implement. To what extent are you using artificial intelligence and more specifically machine learning in the Slack that those of us who use Slack experience every day?
Yeah, I think the answer is both interesting and kind of boring in that it's in many of the features that you use, but I think that what we have started to do and what more and more people are starting to do is use ML for personalization on a small scale. It's for making something a little bit more intelligent and a little bit better. It's every time there is ranking of something, whether that's like ranking of search results or a channel when you switch to it or the person's name in autocomplete when you go to DM somebody, it's making sure that that is slightly personalized to you based on your past behavior and a whole bunch of other signals that we record. And I think the effect that we really are starting to see of ML application across a wide variety of products is making the small interactions a little bit better. So it's that kind of background magic that you don't necessarily, it's not like some big splashy thing, it's everything getting a bit better.
Do you see that changing over time? In other words, could there be a massive breakthrough that would allow me to find that dang message that I sent 3 days ago that was in the channel, you know, down here buried? Like that's where I want the AI and the ML.
I mean, you know, that's the kind of AI dream is, you know, your robot assistant that does is better than a human being and does everything perfectly. We're not going to get there incrementally. You know, it's not going to be like a tiny bit better until suddenly it's like a human level intelligence. That's going to be some weird step function at some point. But I think that there is a lot of incremental gain that we can get along the way there of just making things a little bit better over time. You know, one of our goals from product point of view is that the longer you use the product and the more information that you put in it and the more signal we can gather, the better it can respond to you and understand. Like when you wake up in the morning, this is the first person whose DMs you always read from. That's probably somebody who's really important to you. That's how quickly you respond to them. These are the topics that you talk about, things like that, so that we can personalize it to you. But I think that's going to be a lot of incremental changes over time.
All right. It's been interesting on the retail side, obviously away from enterprise collaboration, to see how Amazon's retail competitors make cloud decisions based on their concerns about another sector of their business. Of course, you're in an interesting situation because Microsoft has Azure and then competes with Slack via Teams and Office 365. Now, Amazon has dabbled in collaboration apps, but they have not yet taken on Slack directly. Would you reconsider your relationship with AWS if Jeff Bezos were to take out a full-page ad taking Slack on?
if he gets
that reference.
so we use a bit of GCP and a bit of Azure as well. So I think that we think about that pretty independently.
Yeah, are you confident enough in Amazon's business firewall to make that leap if Amazon were to compete with you directly?
It's hard to imagine Amazon using AWS as leverage against competitors because it's a big, important business for them, and that would be a daring, weird move.
It's interesting. You were hired by Stuart Butterfield after breaking into the listserv for his video game company. Is that apocryphal or is that a true company?
I mean, breaking into is a strong term. They just hadn't changed the default admin password. But but I was just super interested in this original game he was working on and was trying to gain every bit of leverage I could to find out more about the company. And fascinating at the time was in a kind of era before web APIs, and I was really interested in building some kind of data visualization and tools around the game. And so I wanted to understand how the internals work so I could build a public API on top of it. And getting into the internal mailing list was definitely the way to do that. And I wouldn't necessarily say that that's the greatest idea, but at the time it certainly got that conversation going.
That's great. I was going to ask you if you would recommend that tactic to job seekers today. So,
you know, well, I think the equivalent now, as the industry has matured a lot, is like public bug bounty programs, and that's definitely how we've ended up meeting a lot of people in the like information security space.
Yeah, absolutely. When you're hiring for the Slack engineering team, what are the key skills, expertise, or perhaps more importantly, mindset that you're looking for in the people that you're hiring?
Oh, that's a good question. And I mean, I think that has changed a ton over time because we've gone from a 4-person company to 1,500 plus people today. And so, you know, the people that you hire in week one are very different to the people that we hire in year 10 of the company at this point. And I think that one of the things that we really focus around, both because of the product and I think the way that we think about building software, is like being collaborative as an attribute of candidates that we look for. Because as work in general has become more and more complex, you know, both from a changing external pressures of markets and technology moving faster than ever, and internal pressures of different expectations around people's relationship to the workplace, more and more work has become teamwork. You know, as more and more work has become knowledge work and other work has been automated away, kind of especially in our industry, that the kind of myth of the lone programmer who like goes into the basement and hammers away at a keyboard for a month and comes out with some kind of perfect gem of software is like just so far from the reality of large-scale software development today. It's such a team sport that collaboration is really at the core.
In terms of pure tech, 2-3 years out, are there specific things that you bet on or that you think about when you're doing those interviews and bringing people on and building the product?
Yeah, I think that what's the rate of change has really been increasing over the kind of, especially over the last 5 years in technology, that a lot of the standards of how people build today, whether it's kind of any layer of the stack, have real, like, completely changed over the last 5 years. So Slack's not a very old company, for sure, but when we look at, say, our main web client that the majority of our customers use, the technology that we would build that with today just didn't exist when we started building the company. And so we have a big focus on making sure that we're using modern but not necessarily totally bleeding edge technology, because that's hugely impactful when we look at recruiting. It's like, what is the skill set that the majority of people, say, in front-end engineering roles, what is the technology that they've worked with, and what can they bring to the organization? If we're using totally unique things and totally unique ways of working and building that nobody's familiar with, that just makes recruiting and onboarding so much harder. So whilst we're definitely, on the one hand, looking at where kind of technology trends are going, we're very, like, focused on what has been largely adopted over the last couple of years that we can adopt to.
Now, of course, Slack is also a platform. As you think about the Slack API, what kinds of apps would you like to see built on Slack in the future? And I'm thinking particularly about gaps that you'd like to see and things that developers in this audience might capitalize on.
Yeah, I think that when I think personally about how I use Slack to get work done, I think that the best uses of the platform have definitely been around how can you take a piece of software that you already use for some particular vertical, for some particular task that you do, and make it a bit better by using it with Slack. Make it a bit more efficient, make it a bit more accurate, make you a bit more faster, make it feel better. So one that immediately comes to mind is the way that we use Google Docs for a ton of stuff internally. You know, if I'm sharing a spreadsheet or a presentation or a document, it's in Google Docs. And if you share a Google document via email, you paste in a URL and somebody receives a URL, like whatever. If you paste it into Slack, we'll pull out the title and show you the first page in line so you know what the contents of the document are. But far more importantly, if I send you the URL to a Google Doc, Slack will tell me, I haven't given you permission yet. Would you like me to fix it right now before you open it up? And I think that has probably collectively saved me about 500 hours over the last 5 years. And that alone is like, it just makes using Google Docs more enjoyable. You know, or we use Jira for issue tracking. So every time I type a Jira case number into Slack, instead of just being the case number, we link it to Jira and pull out the title and the status. So it's thinking about the software that you use every day, how could it be made more efficient and a little bit better in the context of the discussion when you're working with other people? So how can you enrich that usage of those applications?
It's interesting because that really gets back to Stuart's original vision and your original vision when you launched the company, was making Slack the hub, and so bringing those capabilities into Slack rather than leaving them to just simply operate independently in the app, in another
app. Yeah, I think it's really the context of bringing together all of the different applications that you use for getting a piece of work done and bringing them into one place.
Yeah. One last question here, and we're out of time, unfortunately, but you're very public about the fact that you're colorblind.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And you talk about this on your site, iamcal.com.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I imagine that must give you a real degree of empathy with technology users in general and the issue of accessibility in general. How has that influenced your life, your career as an engineer, and what could you impart to this audience about that?
That is a great question. So, like, a huge number of people, especially men in the US, are colorblind. Like, 1 in 8 has some form of colorblindness. So it's this weird, like, not really a disability because so many people have it kind of thing. But I think the main outcome is everybody I work with is sick of hearing me tell them I can't tell the difference between two lines on a graph. But I think that it is that kind of realization that there's a whole bunch of extra things that go into designing software at scale for people to use to make it more accessible. And especially with the product that we've built, Slack doesn't work unless everybody on your team can use it. So, you know, it doesn't work if you have somebody who's colorblind and can't actually read any of the text, or somebody with low vision, or somebody with no vision at all and needs to use a screen reader, or somebody using assistive devices, this isn't a disability, but somebody who uses Linux. So So I think it's important to you know, think about all of those kind of aspects, because we're building an application that has to work for everybody, or it doesn't work for anybody.
Right. That 10 million needs to become exponentially more in the years to come.
Yeah.
What would you like to get across to this crowd of business leaders, business decision makers, and developers and engineers that we have not yet talked about as a concluding remark here, Cal?
I mean, I think going back to the cloud piece that we talked about a little bit is that when you are like in the early days of making a software or product startup company, the most important thing to do is to optimize for that speed of iteration and finding product market fit first. It is not, and it's easy to be swayed by interesting technology at scale or interesting technology on the bleeding edge or what it could be far in the future, but really optimizing for that, how can you get that iterative loop quickly and leveraging the, you know, the providers and the technology that are available to help speed that up can really is the thing that's going to make a difference between you spending a long time on something that doesn't work out, as we've done a couple of times with video games, and, you know, finding that product market fit and starting that growth.
Yep. Cal Henderson, the co-founder and CTO of Slack, thank you very much for being here at the Cloud Summit.
Thank you.
Cal Henderson is the co-founder and CTO of Slack, the workplace chat and collaboration technology company that will go public later this week on June 20th with a direct listing on the stock market. We'll talk more about what that means and the implications of Slack's business for its future growth in a follow-up episode later this week with a PitchBook analyst who just completed a major report on the company. Until then, I'm GeekWire editor Todd Bishop. Thanks for listening, everybody. Don't forget to subscribe to the show in your favorite podcast app. Leave us a rating and a review, and we'll talk to you next time on GeekWire.